This is the State of Things broadcasting from the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences in downtown Raleigh. I'm Frank Stasia with a reminder that you can watch a live stream of the show right now at stateofthings.org. Rainforests, you know, are home to an incredible variety of species. There are furry raccoon cousins, bugs named after drool, flying snakes, and even sneaky elephants. And we can be pretty sure that there are still countless species yet to be discovered. Of all the habitats on Earth, rainforests are some of the least known and least understood. An exhibit called Rainforest Adventure educates kids on the habitat of diversity and the diversity of conservation. It's at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences, and let's listen.
The soil in rainforests is rich in nutrients. True or false?
Well, let's see.
We will get the answer in just a moment because we have three experts from the museum today. Jason Cryan is an entomologist. He studies insects. Jason, welcome. It's good to have you here.
Hi, Frank. Thanks.
Also with us is Brian Stewart, who is a herpetologist. He studies amphibians and reptiles. Welcome back, Jason.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And Brian, I should say, Jason, I already welcomed you once, and I'm not going to welcome you again. Brian, it's your turn. Welcome. And Roland Kays is a zoologist. He specializes in mammals. Roland, welcome. Good to have you
back.
Hey,
great to be here.
So, Jason, let me ask you, first of all, the idea that rainforests are diverse. By the way, fertility of the soil, are they rich in nutrients?
The rainforest soil is not really rich. It's got a very thin topsoil level, and it's not really rich in nutrients, actually. It's contrary to popular belief.
See, that's what you would think, but that kid knew.
Right.
Because
they
came here and they studied.
Indeed.
And that's really great. So they are diverse, though, and that's interesting. What accounts for the diversity?
Yeah, so there are a couple of reasons that rainforests are so diverse, and it really stems mostly from the climate in the tropics. So the tropical zone is typically associated with high rainfall through the year and also high temperatures. That does a couple of things. It allows a lot of very high primary productivity, so a lot of plant life, making a complex forest structure. And then it allows for animals and plants to kind of avoid that dormancy period that we associate with winters here in the temperate zone. And so they can continually grow and continually produce throughout the year. And so those combination of factors really contributes to a high rate of diversity and high rate of evolution.
Do you ever thought that dormancy was a good thing? It gives us a chance to rest and improves our chances for surviving.
Certainly some species do that, but others don't need that.
All right, Brian, you study amphibians, reptiles, that sort of thing, many of them nocturnal, meaning you have to do a lot of your work at night, I guess, huh?
We do. I work extensively in tropical parts of Southeast Asia and also in Central Africa. And we do a lot of our field work in the rainforest actually at night. At night is when many of the creatures that I'm interested in actually become active, things like frogs and snakes and gecko lizards. And so essentially my group, we go out at night with headlamps, and we scan the forest floor, and we scan the vegetation around us, and walk through the forest and see what we can find.
And which leads to some kind of strange encounters, right, with animals that also are creeping about at night.
It certainly does. One of the very exciting things about working in Gabon in Central Africa is Gabon is home to about half of the world's remaining forest elephants. Now, forest elephants are amazing animals, wonderful animals, but they can move through the forest quite very silently. And perhaps every other night we're out there, we'll be working, we'll be looking for frogs and snakes and lizards, and very suddenly we'll start on an elephant that none of us saw because it's behind such dense vegetation only 20 or 30 feet away. And the elephant will trumpet and crash away in one direction, and we'll crash away in the opposite direction.
What a sight. In the middle of the night, all these headlamps bounding in one direction, trumpeting elephants in the other. But the prospect of elephants as a herd making their way through the forest silently is also kind of an amazing thought.
Yeah, it's really
very
remarkable.
Cool stuff. Roland, you focus on mammals, and you and your team discovered the Olingito, or it's certainly a lot about it. Tell us about the lovely – we talked about the Olingito before.
Yeah, sure. So the Olingito is a new species that we described last year. It's in the Carnivora, which is the group that includes raccoons and bears and weasels and cats, and it's the first new carnivore in the New World in 35 years. And I sort of like to say – so mammalogists describe new species really every year, but usually they're bats and rats. rats. And this got a lot of attention because of how cute it is. So I like to say it's the first new cute mammal in 35 years.
Olingito. He's got a little diminutive at the end of his name.
He's it is the smallest member of the raccoon family. Yeah.
So cool. See, and Jason, you hate the mammalogist, don't you? Because you're the bug guy.
He is furry.
No, you do. You do. You resent them.
Well, there's a little bit of one-upsmanship going on. Sure, sure.
Yeah, mammal envy. Well, tell us about it, because you've got these ugly little bugs. They're important to us, but
indeed,
they are not as cute as the Olingito.
That's true. And so entomologists and invertebrate zoologists in general, we are kind of privileged to describe and discover new species at a much higher rate than other taxonomic groups. But we don't get the respect. Yeah. We don't get the cute factor.
They see, if this were a bar, they'd be, yeah, but we got more than you do. I don't care how we study you anymore.
Exactly.
And why, what do they tell us, though? It is important to know about these. And so what's the practical benefit of this for all of us?
So biodiversity really is the study of and discovery of the variety of life out there. And we know so very little about what's really out in the world. And rainforests in general are, as you said before, understudied. And so no matter what the taxonomic group, it's very important to understand what animals and plants are out in the world to characterize the world that we live in.
Now, because the rainforest is exceptional, is anything we learn transferable from the bugs that you find there?
Yeah, absolutely. So, certainly we can make connections with human activity. So, for example, the insects that I study have within that group some of the most important economic pests in our world. So that we are talking about pests of rice and corn and wheat, sugarcane, these kind of major agricultural crops. And the insects that I study do millions and millions of dollars of damage annually to these crops. Putting them into an evolutionary context by studying the broader biodiversity around the world is a very important thing.
You study them to kill them. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I don't particularly, but perhaps the information that I generate could be used for
So there are parallels then, these economic pests that you say. And you're not talking about Wall Street here. You're talking about
real-world
insects and the – yeah.
Absolutely.
So give us an example of something that you may have studied there that could help farmers.
Right. Well, so one of the groups that I study is this group called spittlebugs, and you've kind of made an allusion to that. Slimy little guys, and they're called that because the nymphs, the larvae of these things, produce kind of these copious spittle masses. They're really kind of slimy-looking little things. And yet they're very diverse in the tropics. They're very diverse in the rainforest, but they include, as I said before, some of the most important pests of the agricultural world.
I see. And tell us more about the spittlebug, because it's got an interesting sort of life.
Yeah. So as I mentioned, the babies of these things, the nymphs, they're all plant eaters. They're all sap suckers, and so they ingest the liquid tissue of plants, and they pass it through their bodies in such kind of high volumes that they have to do something with it. They excrete this stuff and put some mucopolysaccharide proteins in it to make this bubbly mass. They live inside and develop inside these masses, and that protects them from desiccation, from drying out. It protects them from predation and from parasitism. They develop into adults in these spittle masses, and then they come out as free-living winged insects, and they fly around, and they look for mates after that.
You have just created 14 Twitter handles in about a minute and a half. That's amazing.
Indeed.
So are they mobile, or do they attach themselves in that stage?
So the nymphs will be pretty sessile. They'll be pretty stable on the plant. They don't really move around quite a bit. The adults are free-living, and they can hop around and fly around and be free-living that way.
Which means there are some trees where they like to aggregate.
Indeed.
That fool people into thinking it's raining, right?
That's right. So one of the phenomena that we claim is our entomological claim to fame is the rain tree phenomenon in Africa. And so there are certain trees that are so populated by these spittlebugs, dripping this slimy fluid all the time, that it's in essence raining underneath that tree.
Well, and does that contribute in any way to the – I mean, so does that stuff then contribute to the nutrients? We said it was not a nutrient-dense soil.
Right.
But
well, I wouldn't suspect so. The liquid that they're passing through is not nutrient rich in itself.
It's waste.
It's waste.
Yeah, it's waste. Brian, you have discovered some wonderful species yourself in some of your work, including the dreaded a frog that has a kind of a terrifying name.
Oh, you must be referring to the vampire flying frog.
Yeah.
This is a species of tree frog that my colleagues and I described from tropical rainforests of southern Vietnam a few years ago. We gave it that name. Well, first of all, it is indeed a flying frog. There is a group of frogs in tropical Southeast Asia that have the ability to glide from tree to tree, and this is a member of that group. And anyway, we gave it that name because the tadpole has these very unusual fang-like structures in its mouth that are not seen in any other tadpole of any other frog species anywhere in the world.
And what does it do? Why are those fangs there?
Well, this frog reproduces by laying its eggs in water-filled tree holes. And tree holes are a wonderfully safe place to put your eggs and your tadpoles. There aren't many predators there, but unfortunately there's not much for the tadpoles to eat. And so the mother frog, what she does is she returns to the water-filled tree hole cavity and she lays unfertilized eggs in that tree hole cavity to feed her tadpoles.
Whoa.
And the tadpole uses those fang-like structures to feed on those unfertilized eggs.
Well, and you also there is also the taboo frog, right?
Yeah, that's a fun one. That's a species that I described a few years ago from a remote area in the tropical rainforest of Laos. And there we were working with an ethnic group of people called the Driyu, and their lives are greatly influenced by taboos. One of the problems we ran into during that field work was coincident with our trip to the rainforest in their area was a typhoon. And somebody got the idea that perhaps the reason these heavy rains came that caused some damage in the village was because we were there studying these water-dwelling amphibians like frogs. And so we had a big sit-down with the village chief, and the problem was solved through a ceremony where the villagers bled a chicken and mixed it with stream water and scattered it around the area where we were working. And that resolved the problem. But anyway, one of the species of frogs that we discovered on that trip, I named it the taboo frog. I gave it the scientific name Otorana kalum. And the word kalum means taboo in the Lao language.
Wow. And I guess so that's one of the other sort of interesting and fascinating things about your jobs is not only do you get to study the science, but when you go to these places on the globe, you absorb a lot of the culture as well.
Absolutely.
And a salamander among the unexploded bombs.
That's right. You know, we see these really fascinating and interesting parts of human culture, such as what I just described with working with the Driyu people in southern Laos. Unfortunately, we see sadder parts of recent human history in some of our field work. Many of the areas where I work in Laos lie along what was formerly the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And so during the American-Vietnamese War, that area in Laos, in those mountains that straddle the border of Laos and Vietnam, they happen to be very, very biodiversity-rich, very interesting area to scientists. But unfortunately, that area endured a lot of conflict and a lot of bombing from American forces that were trying to stop Vietnamese troop lines moving through Laos. And so today, when we go to those areas and do field work, we'll see quite a bit of unexploded ordnance or bomb crater ponds in the forest. And a few years ago, we were working in an area along the former Ho Chi Minh Trail in the rainforest, and we found a new species of salamander. It's called the southern knobby newt, Tylototriton nodialis. And that species, the first specimen we found was under a log, and about 6 feet away was a large a bomb that had been dropped by American forces still stuck in the ground that had never exploded. So we have to be very, very, very cautious during that field work that we don't inadvertently step on anything.
How do you know when you find a salamander like this? Is it obvious to you on site that you've got something new, or do you have to sort of take it to the lab and
Well, that's a very good question. Sometimes in the field we find species, and I call those novel new species, where we sort of instantly recognize that they differ in their external appearance from all other known species in that group. And because I'm familiar with the groups of organisms that live in the area where I work, we often will recognize in the field we've got something new. In many other cases, we don't realize we have something new until many years later. When we come back into here to the museum and we compare it with other specimens of very similar organisms and we find that they differ in their external appearance, or we sequence their DNA, or in the case of things like frogs, we'll study their call differences. So sometimes they don't necessarily look very different to the human eye, and it's these other characters that actually reveal that these are separate from all of the known species.
Roland, we'll move into the mammals again and talk a little bit about some of your research, which actually was advanced by basically crowdsourcing, right? In some ways.
Well, so what was fun about this Olenghito discovery was it did make a lot of news, and it was news all around the planet. It was news, importantly, in Colombia and Ecuador, which is where the species lives. And after that, we started getting all sorts of emails and tweets about other people thinking they may have seen the animal themselves. And so people would send us these pictures and say, oh, I think this is an Olenghito, is it? And sometimes it would not be. Sometimes it would be an Olingo, or it'd be a Kinkajou, which is another thing that looks more or less similar. But sometimes it really was an Olenghito. And so this turned out to give us a lot of new data about where this animal lives that we didn't know before. So by sort of getting this into the media and getting all this information, we actually know a lot more about where they live with more verified localities that we can now use. We're actually looking to do a reanalysis now of what their habitat use is based on these new records on top of the old ones we had.
You know, Jason, that actually leads to this sort of an interesting phenomenon where what is new to the sort of the Western scientist may be just old news to the folks who live there. How much do you rely on sort of local wisdom?
Well, I think that's a very interesting question, and I think some taxonomic groups lend itself better to that phenomenon. So we have a scientist on staff here, Dr. Art Bogan, who's a malacologist. One of his primary collecting techniques is to go to markets in Vietnam and look at clams and snails and whatnot that are in the market. So your point is very good, is that sometimes things that are new to science have been known by the local cultures for many years.
Well, and that, Brian, I guess raises the question about whether the local folks just wonder what's wrong with you. I mean, this is, you know, if somebody came to me and said, we're really interested in pigeons, I'd really be curious about why they cared. Do you ever get some of that, people wondering what on earth you would be interested in this very common thing in their lives?
Well, I think people wonder all the time as I work with, villagers in rural areas in Laos or Vietnam or in Gabon. Sort of wonder why this American scientist would come so far away, travel so far, and leave his a putatively comfortable life back in America to spend time here in the rainforest where we're dealing with uncomfortable conditions and such as heavy rain and leeches and whatnot, and just for the purpose of studying frogs and snakes. And I think that question is always on people's minds. But what I've learned over the years is, simply spending a few days with people, and I think that they recognize my genuine interest in these species, many of which are very familiar to them. But they can recognize that to me, it's quite amazing, some of these little.
And Roland, I'll address this to you, but I'd be happy to hear from any of you in the minute or so we have left. There's a serious question being raised these days about us going in, those Western scientists who go into other parts of the world, pulling things out but not always making it available in the local language to the local folk so that they can have the benefit of this. Is this something that you're concerned about and are working
on? I think we're on top. I think I was going to say we're on top of that, but it's very much on our minds, and it's an important part of every expedition that we have local students that are involved, that we work with local museums especially. And, a key part to any of these species descriptions is having specimens in museums and that's where they're available for study. Like Brian said, sometimes you don't even realize what you've got until you go back and look at that. And these days, it's certainly within the mammals, typically you end up working with a local museum and leaving half the specimens there and bringing half the specimens back so that they are available in the country for local students, and often involving training of the students and working with local professionals at the same time.
And the write-up in local languages.
Well, in our case, Spanish. Yeah, we did when we released the Olenghito, we had a press conference in Quito at the same time as we did up here in North Carolina.
Always a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks so much for being on the show. Roland Kays is a zoologist, Brian Stewart, a herpetologist, Jason Cryan, an entomologist, all scientists at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. And most of what we talked about is at our website. You can see the pictures there and watch the live stream at stateofthings.org. Thank all of you for being on the program.
Thank you.
Great to talk
thanks for coming
you.
To the museum.
Thank coming
you.
Up, this year's Piedmont Laureate and the history of art and the short story. Stay with us.